I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. John McCain's rise is less a crusade than a crush, says the speechwriter Peggy Noonan in this morning's Wall Street Journal. He's the mythical flyboy, authentic, brave, adorable, an outsider, a man's man. We're enchanted by the medals on damp and smoky wool of John McCain's Navy uniform. He's captured all our imaginations, not least because he's such a relief from the other guy in the race, the mythical boss's son. This is some of the romance of the Republican senator from Arizona who didn't do much in the Delaware primary yesterday but could win the head-to-head test with George W. Bush in South Carolina next week. He's the man who's winning the coverage campaign hands down since he thumped Bush in New Hampshire. But is it the real John McCain? The man who says, and it's part of his charm, I've lived a very, very flawed life. Referring not only to sins in his first marriage, but to a close brush with a big money scandal in the Keating Five case of savings and loan special pleading years ago. Who is John McCain anyway, Connection listeners? And how did he promote himself into the place where he could now promote himself toward the presidency? Is he the antithesis of Bill Clinton, as Peggy Noonan asks in the Journal? Or is he more nearly Clinton 2? The real John McCain Connection phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined this hour by a number of reporters who cover John McCain closely, starting with Ed Walsh of the Washington Post. We'll be joined by Bill Mueller of the Arizona Republic and others who've known John McCain. Give him a call at 1-800-423-8255. Ed Walsh of the Washington Post did an important series in the Post in January about John McCain. Ed Walsh, you were saying that the story boils down to, as everybody says, himself. It's the John McCain story. It's a story of survival with honor. Is that what's working here? And more important, is the story true? How close is it to the whole truth?
Well, Chris, I think certainly the story of his captivity in Vietnam is true. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. It's pretty well documented.
I'm told that David Hackworth doubts it, but that maybe is another hour. Do you know the David Hackworth dissent on this story?
No, I'm not aware of that at all.
Okay, well, we'll both check it. Go ahead.
I think it's pretty well documented, in, not only in McCain's own book, Faith in My Fathers, but in Bob Timberg's wonderful book, The Nightingale Song, which tells the story of five Naval Academy graduates who served in Vietnam and then later went on to quite prominent positions in politics, McCain being one of them. In terms of the substance of the story, the 5.5 years in prison camps in North Vietnam, the 2 years in solitary confinement, the beatings and so on and so forth, the refusal to accept early release, which the North Vietnamese offered to McCain, I mean, that's all true. And I've never heard anyone really challenge the substance of that story.
No, and I don't mean to challenge it either. It's a story of defiance, of toughness. It rings completely true with the spirit of the man and the stories you hear about him at Annapolis, telling everybody basically to go to hell. Bad student at Annapolis, but we won't need to linger on that necessarily, but he was fifth from the bottom of his class. He succeeded his father at the bottom of his class, and his grandfather had been a lousy student.
Right. Well, it's a really interesting family once you get into it. The grandfather, John
Slew McCain,
Sidney McCain, and Slew was an extraordinarily colorful figure who makes Senator McCain look like milquetoast in many ways. And the family has this wonderful sort of downward spiral in academic performance at the academy. Slew McCain finished in the bottom fifth of his class. His son, Admiral John McCain Jr., finished 18th from the bottom, and John McCain III, the senator, finished 5th from the bottom.
Going back to the prisoner of war camp, there's one very interesting thing that comes out in yours and other stories. The story of Norris Overly, yeah, who was a major shot down or in the camp with him, mm-hmm, who nursed John McCain back to life. John McCain says, I wouldn't be here but for Norris Overly. And yet they didn't speak for 25 years. Has anybody penetrated that mystery? He left. Overly took early release from the Vietnamese, mm-hmm, and McCain shunned him.
That's right. And I asked Senator McCain about that, and he's never really explained why that was. When McCain was released from prison in 1973, now Colonel Overly called him to welcome him back home, and they had a very brief, very perfunctory conversation, and Never spoke again until roughly sometime last year when out of the blue, McCain called him and said, Gene Norris, if you're ever up in Washington, please stop by and see me. McCain has never explained either why he ignored this man for so long or why last year he suddenly decided to make contact with him. All he will say, and he says this about many aspects of his life, that it was a mistake, that he owes his life to Norris Overly, and that it's a legitimate criticism of him that he ignored this man for so long.
Ed Walsh, I wish you'd comment on what you know about the period before John McCain was a senator. He was the Navy's liaison with the Senate. He was a close friend of Gary Hart, among others, Bill Cohen, now Secretary of Defense. He was one of those kind of aggressively ambitious Navy and defense intellectuals trying to figure what became known as the small ship Navy, a more flexible defense. It was an interesting time among interesting guys. What does it tell you?
Well, what happened to McCain was John McCain really had decided, although as a young man, he sort of resented in some ways his predestination for a career in the Navy. He eventually came to terms with it and was quite serious about it. There came a time in the 70s when he realized, because of his physical limitations stemming from the prisoner of war experience, that he was unlikely ever to reach the rank of admiral, which both his father and grandfather had. And at the same time, he happened to be assigned as the Navy's liaison to the Senate. The closest relationship he probably developed during that time was with the late Senator John Tower of Texas. Gary Hart describes it as almost a father-son relationship. But McCain was he's always been kind of a fun-loving guy, and he really developed a friendship with these two young senators, Gary Hart of Colorado and Bill Cohen of Maine. They spent a lot of time together traveling overseas on long overseas trips that the Armed Services Committee members would make, and he... it is at this point that McCain, realizing that a career in the Navy was probably going to come to an end, really began to develop an interest in politics. And according to Hart, at least, really pursued it quite aggressively, wanted to know everything that he could learn about how the Senate worked and why senators did what they did.
Larry Smith, who was a civilian in that circle of kind of military reform thinkers, says that John McCain's tactical campaign against George W. Bush is built, a lot of it, maybe subconsciously, on the defense strategies that he learned in that period, in the early 80s, late 70s. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I'm not familiar with those strategies. I'm not a military expert, but there is a certain sort of guerrilla warfare aspect to the McCain campaign. And so if that's what he's referring to, then I suppose there's something to that.
Larry Smith said in the New Yorker it was... they talked a lot about a new, evolving, more flexible military doctrine called maneuver strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And then he laughed. He said, in fact, McCain's using one of the basic maneuver principles of aerial attack right now. You find the opponent's soft spot, which in this case is New Hampshire. Identify your strongest tactical path, which in this case is mobilizing the veterans. And then you try to get inside his reaction loop. The technical term is OODA loop, and disorient him. Larry Smith, I think he had all of this worked out a year ago. Who knows? I'd like to introduce Bill Mueller from the Arizona Republic, who wrote a long series on the life of John McCain in October when he was still a very, very long shot. Bill Mueller, it's a marvelous series written, I would say, from a kind of acerbic distance from John McCain's politics. Could I just begin with a blunt question about every local politician? In your view, Bill Mueller, who made John McCain? Who got him started? Who launched the career in Arizona?
Well, I'm glad Ed mentioned the trips overseas, because that's pretty much what launched John McCain. He was overseas in Hawaii, and he ran into a young woman named Cindy Hensley, who was the daughter of a very powerful, rich beer distributor here in Phoenix.
Mr. Budweiser in Phoenix, right?
Exactly. I mean, he controlled the entire Budweiser distributorship for Maricopa County, which is a county which is larger than some states, actually. And he met this woman. He wined her. He dined her. They ended up getting married. They moved to Arizona. He was given a job in the Hensley company. But he soon became interested in politics through his connections and his family. He met the publisher of the local newspaper at that time, was a man named Duke Tully, who is well known in journalism circles for having made up a military career. Tully told people he had been a combat pilot and he had a big affinity for actual combat pilots, and he could actually fly the planes. He had been in the simulators and he could do it, and he convinced McCain that he had actually been a combat pilot. The two men hit it off. They both were married to much younger women. They both were on their second marriages. Through those connections, he met other people, including Fife Symington, who would later become the governor of the state, only to be convicted of bank fraud. Now, that conviction has been overturned on appeal, I must say. I must be quick to note. He also met Charlie Keating at that time, who was a developer and you know, gave a lot of money to a lot of different politicians. So you had through his marriage and through the people that he got to know and through his very close friendship with Duke Tully, the publisher of the Arizona Republic and at that time the Phoenix Gazette, McCain was able to network and get to know the right people and get the newspaper behind him. And he was unknown, but he raised over $500,000. In part through his family connections, to run a four-way race and win the Republican primary in 1982.
You mentioned a very interesting network. I know those are exactly the three names that I would have, you know, picked out of your series as the critical ones. Duke Tully, a military fraud and a powerful publisher, his father-in-law Jim Hensley, the beer distributor, and Charlie Keating, famous as the bad guy, the godfather of Republican politics in Arizona, and the bad guy in the Keating Five. Tully probably never got into any criminal problems, but that's an interestingly checkered group as to be the sponsors of John McCain.
Well, yeah, and McCain has other friends who have had equally problems. I mean, John Tower, as you recall, if you remember them trying to make John Tower Secretary of Defense, and those terribly, straining confirmation hearings where John Tower's fairly checkered past came out in all its glory, and he was not confirmed. And later he was tragically killed in a plane crash in Georgia. And then, of course, you had Gary Hart, whose own problems, of course, surfaced with the monkey business and Donna Rice and all those problems. So, I mean, McCain, he ran with a fast crowd in those days. And I'm not saying – I mean, John Tower was a natural for McCain to get to know when he was the Navy liaison officer, and certainly Gary Hart. But, Bill Cohen, who is not probably considered to be in that group, it was best man at John McCain's wedding here in Arizona. So McCain, yeah, there are some people in his past, especially Keating, who you kind of wonder, did he recognize that this could be a problem later on down the line?
I wish, Bill Mueller, you'd just deal with the sort of spin question about John McCain. Duke Tully was a master of spin. In a certain sense, he spun John McCain as a new boy in town into a congressional seat. But John McCain was always extremely adept at mastering the story, as he is now, dealing with reporters. But there was one very illuminating whole puzzle around his wife's confession of a sort of pill addiction 4 or 5 years ago, which was a serious family crisis, obviously, and an important statement on her part, but it was also marked by John McCain's very aggressive mastery of press relations. Can you tell that story in a kernel?
Well, yeah, I mean, John McCain, Cindy had the drug problem, and she had been addicted to painkillers. She had a lot of back problems, and this happened. She was with a relief group that was going overseas giving medication to third world countries, which is so certainly a noble effort on her part. She became addicted to these pills, and she took some of the pills from the relief agency. Nobody knew this, and Cindy, at a certain point, her parents confronted her, and she got clean. Then it became clear that someone in town was working on the story. So McCain had Jay Smith, one of his top political advisors at that time, call friendly reporters around town for individual interviews at the McCain home. One of those reporters was the late John Colby, who you'll see throughout John McCain's career, somebody who has supported him as an editorial writer. And they sat down, and she spun the tale of, I mean, she came out and was very honest and very very emotional and said, yeah, this happened, and I just wanted everybody to know. Well, what didn't come out is there was a whole other side of the story, and that there was a whistleblower who had contacted DEA who accused Mrs. McCain of firing him because he knew too much about the drug use. There was a 212-page investigation that had been done by the Maricopa County Attorney's Office that was full of interviews of all these people who worked for the relief agency. So there was a more ugly side to the story. And certainly there was more to the story than these reports were told, and kind of tellingly, the Arizona Republic, which off and on has not got along with McCain, that reporter from that newspaper was not invited to these individual interviews, so the paper just went and reported the story and found all this stuff out in the next weeks, and even tried to interview the whistleblower and got these documents and put the story out. So the attempt to spin it worked for a couple of days, but then it kind of spun out of control. I don't think anybody felt like it was, Mrs. McCain was necessarily at fault, but I think it was a definite attempt to control the story and to get it out on McCain's terms, and especially this calling of the individual reporters who they knew would write the kind of sympathetic story or the sympathetic column, and then all these reporters got egg on their face because then all the other facts started coming out, and they felt like, wow, we got snookered.
Bill Mueller, it's an interesting story, and we may come back to it. But Ed Walsh, I'd like you and Bill Mueller both to review the Keating 5 case as it involved John McCain. He was one of five senators who took money and met too often and leaned on the Federal Home Loan Bank Board on behalf of Charlie Keating in the late 80s. John McCain, Dennis DeConcini, Alan Cranston of California, John Glenn of Ohio, Don Riegel of Michigan. It hurt all of them worse than John McCain. How tainted was John McCain in the case, and how did he recover? Maybe you'd start, Ed, and Bill follow up.
I'm sure that Bill knows a lot more about this case than I do, because it involved a major Arizona political figure, Charlie Keating, and at the time both of the state's senators, Dennis DeConcini, a Democrat, and McCain. From what I've read, the way you outlined it is correct. Keating was a major contributor to all of these guys, particularly DeConcini and McCain. He was having trouble with the savings with federal regulators because of a savings and loan that was about to go under. He pressured these senators to meet with the savings and loan federal regulators, but as best I can tell, and Bill can correct me if this is wrong, McCain's role was the most peripheral of the five. I mean, I don't think any of them actually ever did anything except attend these meetings.
Yeah, Keating complained that McCain was a wimp.
Yeah,
others said he was sort of Hamlet. He couldn't figure out whether he wanted to be in the meetings or not.
Keating called McCain a wimp. They had a bitter falling out over this, and in the end, McCain, who was the only Republican among the five, was reprimanded by the Senate for, quote, poor judgment, unquote, which, given the circumstances, is probably about as mild as you could expect. It's always going to be a part of McCain's background. He will bring it up himself as in his sort of self-confessional mode that he's adopted as part of his presidential campaign. But I don't think that it seriously tainted him. Certainly, I mean, I think he's been reelected twice since then. I don't think it hurt him much with Arizona voters, but Bill could address that.
Bill Mueller, how embarrassed should he be, and how did he recover from it?
I want to make a couple of points on this story because it's 12 years old now, and people are kind of like, well, it happened. I mean, there's a couple of things to remember about the Keating Five. One, McCain didn't need to do anything besides go to the meetings. I mean, if you're a regulator and you walk in and there are five U.S. senators sitting there and they say, oh, hey, Charlie Keating asked us to meet with you. I mean, that's all you need to do. I mean, these guys are going to get it. You know, they're not stupid. They're going to realize, wow, this guy has big, powerful friends.
It's 10% of a Senate majority right there.
Exactly. Maybe we should just take a walk. Now, luckily for the federal government, the people that were in that room included some very gutsy lawyers, including a man named Bill Black, who is now a law professor at University of Texas, who didn't bend under that pressure, who actually hung in there. But they bought Keating a tremendous amount of time, and as the downward spiral of linking savings and loan kept going down, it was costing hundreds of millions of dollars. So, I mean, going to the meeting was enough. I mean, it wasn't like they needed a letter-writing campaign or they needed a call. I mean, and there's a quote in my story from Bill Black saying exactly that. It's like you show up in this room and you see these guys sitting there. You know, there's not much more you need to do. Now, in McCain's defense, there were people who did stay with Keating all the way down the line, including Dennis DeConcini, who kept trying to work on Keating's behalf. The other point to remember is, McCain was between a rock and a hard place because he had just got into the Senate. Keating was arguably the most powerful businessman in his state. So he had a choice. He could either totally turn his back on one of his most powerful contributors, or he could go to a meeting that he probably knew was not a good idea. So he was like Hamlet. He was kind of like, I can't do this and I can't do that. So his choice was, I'll kind of go to this meeting. I'll make comments like, well, I don't want to do anything wrong. I mean, McCain actually makes the comment as the meeting begins, if you go back and read the transcript, which you can find on the Internet, you know, I don't want anything to be improper.
Right.
Why would you make that comment? I mean, unless the context was that it could be improper.
He writes that in his letters to leaning on the FCC, too. Sort of, I wouldn't want to interfere in your process here, but...
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to tell you what to do, but here, let me tell you what to do. I mean,
Bill Miller, how did he come back? I mean, how did he shed this burden?
Well, that's the most interesting part, and that's the critical thing in understanding McCain. McCain will not stay down. McCain will not be beaten. McCain is a tough, resilient guy. He showed that in the prison camps in Vietnam, and he showed it in his political career. Every other member of the Keating Five went down eventually, but McCain stayed up. And part of the reason was, by comparison, especially with DeConcini, he looked good because he didn't do as much. But the second thing is, McCain simply tried. He just worked on it. He told his staff, you know, we're just going to talk about the Keating Five. If people ask us questions, we're not going to duck them. We're going to go around the country. We're going to you know, give our side of the story. And then something happened that saved John McCain's political career. In my view, is that the Persian Gulf War broke out. And when the Persian Gulf War broke out, we were just entering this new phase that we've been in for the last 10 years of. Everything's on TV, you know, you CNN and, you know, all these different networks want talking heads. They want somebody to come on, experts. And so John McCain, the day that the pilots were captured, was on television from 6 a.m. to midnight. He was on every station, every channel, and he was constantly brought back on Nightline as an expert in other shows. And this rehabilitated his image in the American public's eye. In fact, you know, he went from being, member of the Keating Five to being John McCain, naval hero and expert on foreign affairs. Mm-hmm. And through that, just being there, working hard. I mean, John McCain was...
Well, he was almost Dan Quayle on the Bush ticket in 88, and he could have been Bob Dole's running mate the last time, too. I mean, he was not obscure before these things, right?
No, he was never obscure, and this is what built him back. I mean, he was somebody that the shows knew they could always call, and he would show up, and he would be there, and he is always on, and he also built a network among the print media, especially from the bigger papers there, Ed's papers, some other papers. He got a reputation around Washington as a senator. You could call if you were pursuing a story. He would give you the straight quote. He wouldn't duck you. He would call you back, and reporters like that. I mean, they like people that will call them back and talk to them and not duck them or just give them, answers that don't make any sense. I mean, that's what brought McCain back.
Bill Miller, Ed Walsh, would you stand by for callers? 1-800-423-8255 makes the John McCain story connection. Richard is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Richard.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Just wondering if your guests have any thoughts as to whether or not part of John McCain's appeal, his populist and media appeal, is the fact that he's the only one of the four candidates who is firmly not a baby boomer. And I'm thinking that maybe we're not suffering so much from Clinton fatigue as boomer fatigue. I mean, we've seen this in the popular culture, not just with the downfall of Gingrich, also in the popular culture with Brokaw's book and Saving Private Ryan. I mean, even the boomers are kind of, they've had enough. Mm.
Ed Walsh, do you want to, it's a very interesting question. Do you want to take it, Ed Walsh?
Sure, Chris. It's interesting that the caller mentions Brokaw's book and Saving Private Ryan, because McCain invariably mentions both of those in his stump speech and talking about the service of what he calls, using Brokaw's title, the greatest generation, and he segues into a little spiel about not doing right by our veterans and how he will as president. I don't know whether people consciously think of the other three, Al Gore, Bill Bradley, and George W. Bush, as baby boomers, and John McCain as not, but there is a certain sort of grown-up aspect to McCain that seems to me is unmistakable. And,
this
fits in really with, you started out by asking me...
Ed, I hate to do this. I got to take a quick break. And thank you for joining us in the first half of this hour. Ed Walsh of the Washington Post will be back. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI, Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about the John McCain story with Bill Mueller of the Arizona Republic and with you. The phone's 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by the culture critic Camille Paglia, author of Sexual Personae, also the Salon.com columnist. She joins us from Philadelphia. We've been talking, Camille Paglia, about who made John McCain in Arizona, why he worked so well in Washington. How do you explain the all-American love affair now with John McCain?
I think there is no such love affair. There is a widespread dissatisfaction with the ostensible Republican nominee Bush, who has stumbled and who was anointed by the Republican establishment, and is, as far as I can see, has no particular fitness to occupy the Oval Office. People are turning to McCain, imagining he's some sort of an honest, maverick outsider, and he's, as far as I'm concerned, he's a cynical opportunist on his own, who has been wildly inflated by the liberal media in Washington, trying to, and successfully, I might point out, trying to derail the Bush candidacy.
Why cynical? Why opportunist?
I've been watching this man. I know nothing about him except what I have seen on the TV. And I, early on during the impeachment crisis, began to intensely dislike him in exactly the way that I disliked Newt Gingrich early on. I must say I'm a registered Democrat, I have to point out, and I'm a current supporter of Bradley.
But fill that in. I mean, there's certainly more going on than just opportunism. I mean, there is a connection. It seems to me, I mean, he's right out of Sexual Persona in a way. Peggy Noonan calls him the flyboy. He's the rebellious veteran. He's a new date.
Absurd.
He's a new date when you're tired of going out with the boss's son.
I think it's absurd. This is a fellow who owed his getting through the Naval Academy, as he did at the bottom of his class, to his you know, his father's prominence. He's as much a product of his father's a placement high in the hierarchy as George W. Bush is. I absolutely loathe people trying to use a war record that was many decades ago as evidence of fitness to govern. John McCain has shown no ability whatever to make the kind of political alliances that you need in order to successfully govern. I as a student of Roman history, I'm extremely suspicious of him as someone who comes from the outside and pretends to be a populist, but in fact has, I believe, strong fascist undercurrents, you know, as much as Buchanan does.
Spell that out. What do you mean by strong fascist undercurrents?
Throughout history, we have this example. The man who opposes himself as the voice of the people, who is a military man, who says he's going to fight for you when he gets there against a corrupt establishment, and in fact operates, as far as we can see, in isolation. Okay, this man has shown no ability whatever to be able to have a dialogue with his colleagues, be able to marshal votes for important legislation, to work with by consensus and by compromise and to get things done. I think this would be a very dangerous person in the White House.
Wow. I mean, this is a different, completely different slant. It's interesting, though. He is quixotic. He did take on this tobacco crackdown that he knew was going to lose. The campaign finance reforms have always been sort of doomed from the start. He does seem to like a certain kind of kamikaze. That's a bad thing to say about a Navy flyer, but I mean, heroic defeats in his congressional efforts. How would that play out in a kind of executive position,
This is a person without executive ability, as far as I can see. He's someone who has suckered the Washington media. He has he's a seductive one-on-one. He was able to succeed in New Hampshire because he goes into people's living rooms. And there is a certain type of personality that is seductive in person. But what I'm looking at is the TV screen, and what I see on the TV screen is a very clumsy, awkward man who speaks to himself in the third person, who is incapable of speaking beyond jargon phrases, who makes big promises, but in fact whose record does not show that he is able to deliver.
He doesn't make big promises. I mean, compared to Al Gore or Bill Bradley, he sort of says, I'll hand the country back to you, but that's not a big promise.
Please. I detest Gore, but I'm afraid to say that he is the only truly qualified candidate in the race right now for the White House.
I think I'm as suspicious as you are of the sort of the Newsweek sell, the big media push for anybody, and John McCain certainly getting it now. How would you say that works? What is it that bonds a fresh candidate like this to the media, to the press bus?
Well, there are two things. Number one, people are really craving for a new start. I mean, I think that people, McCain is benefiting from that. Practically everyone in both parties is sick of the Clinton years and the endless lies. We want to just sweep all the rascals out. I think that ideally it would be great if all of the Clintons, including the Gores, could be to be swept into the dustbin of history. But the problem here is that you have, I think the Washington Press Corps has never been seen more badly than in this McCain episode. I think that they're being, their absence of neutrality, their manipulativeness, their herd instinct, a bunch of lemmings, and even more painful is the absence of a truly masculine man in the lot. They have no idea what authentic masculinity is. This is look at them. I mean, it's just embarrassing. You see Tucker Carlson sitting beaming next to McCain. Okay, you see one nebbish after another coming on the screen and cooing, quelling over this supposedly super jock hero. I happen to know masculine men. I happen to have military men in my family, people who went to war, all of my uncles. And John McCain is not, to me, I'm sorry to say, the example of a hero, someone who's brought this story from the past, who campaigns with a giant poster image of himself as a young man in uniform. It's as nauseating as Ollie North putting on that uniform to go and testify before Congress.
Wow. I just want to pressure on that one last point. You say beware of the guy who talks about his military record years ago. I mean, the modern president is John Kennedy and PT-109. John Hersey made it famous. People wore those tie clips into eternity. What doesn't that tell you? I mean, 5.5 years in captivity, torture, isolation, I mean, most people...
It's absolutely no carryover, okay, into being a good manager or administrator. There's none whatever. I wouldn't even put John McCain in charge of Secretary of Defense. I don't think he's shown any ability whatever to be able to manage. Management is a completely other issue. In warfare, you do want, the solitary hero who's going to go out and be able to, be able to sacrifice himself for the common good. But then afterward, you have to be able to show that you can work in the political context, and that John F. Kennedy certainly did. He was the first person I ever campaigned for. I was 13 years old, and he benefited from the political expertise of both sides of his family, from the Boston milieu, and so on. But I'm sorry that John McCain is a very, to me, dangerous character.
Listen, we're glad to have your warning, and you re-won your title as the most interesting woman in America.
All right, thanks a lot, Chris.
Camille Paglia, thank you enormously for joining us again on The Connection. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Bill Mueller, reporter with the Arizona Republic, is with us by phone. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. Bill Mueller, do you want to comment on Camille Paglia?
Well, I thought it was a great speech, but some of it is fairly ridiculous. I mean, I've done a tremendous amount of research on McCain, and I can tell you, you can say what you want about him, but he's certainly a man's man. He's won that title. And, maybe in this world of technocrats and bureaucrats, when we see this guy coming along who's more of just a regular guy, the media is attracted to him. Also, she kind of portrayed him as some sort of knuckle-dragging Neanderthal, which is, like, ridiculous. I mean, McCain is very well-read. He's very smart. He used to teach, the history of the American novel from memory while he was in prison because he had memorized all these novels. At the same time, I mean, I see her point. The public's always looking for a Perot-type character that is going to sweep into office and change everything. And, I mean, it seems kind of strange that this guy, we're saying, here comes the outsider. I mean, he's been in the Congress since 1982. I mean, I thought outsiders came from outside. I guess he's an outsider in terms of the party, but I mean, he's been part of the Congress for almost two decades. So I see her point there. As far as McCain, the other really interesting point she made, which was that you talked about tobacco and all this stuff, and I mean if you were fairly skeptical or even cynical, you could say that, well, this tobacco fight, the timing of it's kind of interesting. I mean, it came right before the presidential campaign. It was kind of like a way to get in the press and say, look, I'm fighting big tobacco. And then again, if you weren't cynical, you'd say, well, this is a good fight. The other thing to remember is McCain's family fortune is tied up in beer. So even though tobacco is bad, liquor is quicker,
Bill Mueller, stand by. 1-800-423-8255. We're trying to see around the whole of the John McCain story this hour on The Connection. The phone's 1-800-423-TALK. Kathy is on the line. Welcome,
Kathy.
Good
to be here again.
Pleasure.
I was just commenting on something. I'm making multiple connections, but one is that when I look at John McCain and listen to him very carefully, he reminds me of my grandfather who served in World War One and my father who served in Korea. And on a very humane level, when I've gone to my grandfather's house or when my father reminisces, he takes out his photo of a young man on the ship,
Right, sure.
And I'm telling you, when I looked at, I've never gone to a candidate's website before. Last night I was on McCain's website, and I've mostly voted Democrat. I have advanced degrees. I'm a therapist. But let me tell you, I was choked up, and I'm not easily, in that place. And I think this man has a quality that I love personally, which is he has a transcendent wit. He has an ability, whether I agree with him or not on every issue, abortion I don't, to say things in such a way that hits me at a very basic level. And I am galvanized by his wit. And I look for that in my life and in my profession. And I was wondering, on another note, I assume he's from an Irish background.
He is.
I would assume, right? On both,
Well, I think Scott's Irish, and they've been in this country for a couple hundred years, anyway.
I'd let you read more about that background, but I love his spirit. I think that if he disagreed with you, he'd tell you to your face.
He would.
What?
He would.
He'd go down fighting, which I love. think that Camille is, I don't know, I respect her, but...
You don't have to agree with her. I'm not sure I do.
I think she's just very cynical, and I think that he really loves this country. I think he would command respect, and I think he would inspire people like me and people who are sick of the Salucis.
He's really inspired you already. Would you stay inspired? That's the question. Bill Mueller, what do you think?
I'm going to get him tomorrow night.
I think she's right about McCain's wit. He can be funny. I remember when I was talking to him, and some of the people who don't like McCain, the MIA people who think there are POWs still in Vietnam, don't like McCain because of normalization of relations with Vietnam, and they call him the Manchurian Candidate, which is the film about the guy being programmed by communists. And I mentioned that to McCain, and he stood up and stuck his arms out and kind of got this glazed look on his face like he had been hypnotized for a second there. What candidate would do that? You know, I mean, he knew the movie.
He knew the reference. He knew the Lawrence Harvey part,
he knew exactly what to do, you know. And I said, I'm going to toss out a Red Queen, you know, here. And he just started laughing, you know. And I mean, that's the kind of thing. I mean, he is a funny guy. In terms of the energy and getting behind him, I think a lot of people like his message, and that is the bottom line. They like what they hear him say, and I think the war stuff does mean something. I mean, you know, there's a whole generation now, which I'm a part of, which hasn't had to fight in a war. And we look at somebody like John McCain, who gave up 5 years of his life in a prison camp, and we respect that. If we have any, you know, if we have any self-respect, we say, hey, you know, this guy gave up a lot for us. That rings true.
Stand by, Bill Mueller, 1-800-423-8255, and thank you, Kathy. Richard is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, Richard. Welcome.
Bill, I was in Phoenix a while ago and read in the Arizona Republic a rather extensive series of articles on John McCain's handlers, in other words, the people surrounding him, press people, and what have you. Apparently one of them, when Symington was running for governor, a woman was running, was proposing to run against him as a Republican, and they quite virulently pushed her out of the campaign. Or persuaded her not to run. Additionally, they seem to sort of have like a Lee Atwater spin to them. I was wondering if you could make some commentary on that.
Well, there's no doubt that McCain is surrounded by some pretty hard-driving people. You're talking about Barbara Barrett, who they tried to get out of the race, but she did run against Symington in the Republican primary and lost. McCain is surrounded by some fairly smart people, some fairly tough people, and some of them have some reputations. I know one of the people around McCain has the distinction of being tossed out of both not only the state house but the state senate for lobbying a little too strenuously. At the same time, you know, if you're going for all the marbles, you have to get these tough professionals, guys who have been there, know how to get it done. You can't bring Barney Fife and the boys up to Washington and try to win the presidency. And I mean, the one quality of all these people is they're very smart. They're all very smart, and they understand politics, and they've been with McCain for years, and they're very protective of him. And sometimes when they feel like he is being attacked unfairly, they will, you know, they will react, and they will...
What do they do, Bill?
Oh, what do they do?
Yeah.
Well, they just throw their weight around. I mean, they'll call and they'll let people have it over the telephone, reporters or legislators or anyone who, they perceive to be a threat. And
how did they like your series in October?
Well, that was interesting because, I always call the people after something like that runs. And I think their reaction was kind of like, well, we didn't hate it, but we didn't love it because, you know, we wanted more positive stuff in it. We wanted you to interview voters who love John McCain. I think they were very, well, at very, they were upset because I in that article, I noted that Cindy's father had some criminal problems back in the 40s with some liquor sales back in the wild days, and he had actually been convicted of something. He'd never served any time in jail. He was given a suspended sentence of a year, but I guess the grandkids didn't know that Grandpa had had this problem.
Right.
So they read it in the newspaper, and they were a little surprised. That was one thing that they, but, I mean, we thought that as the part of the whole picture. And actually, the second time that those charges came up, they actually were found not guilty, and their defense lawyer was none other than William Rehnquist, Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. So they had some fairly good lawyering back in those days.
1-800-423-8255, the whole John McCain story connection. Dave is calling from Hammond, New York.
Yeah, I think the first time I heard of John McCain was reading a story in, I think, a Guidepost magazine talking about his imprisonment over in Vietnam. And that earned my respect for John McCain right then. Being a high school senior in 73 when the peace treaty was signed, and knowing that guys were over there doing their duty and I didn't have to go because the war was soon to be over. But your caller, or your guest Camille there, I didn't agree with what she had to say about McCain, but I agreed with what she had to say about the folks that are currently residing out in the White House. I think we need to throw them out and get some people in there that we can respect. And that's the connection I want to make. I can't wait till McCain brings his Straight Talk Express to New York State so we can have a chance to hear him straight up.
Dave, thank you. The Clintons are going to be out of there no matter what, under the Constitution. 1-800-423-8255, the John McCain story connection. Dana is calling from Cape Cod.
Hello?
Hello, Dana. Welcome.
Hi. I have a comment. I haven't heard the whole program, but I have yet to hear anyone, you know, talk about what McCain is going to do if he is elected. I mean, all I hear about is all this stale rhetoric.
I can help you with that if you'd like to.
Okay, yeah.
Bill's got the plan. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, he's going to do a lot of things. First thing he's going to do is he's going to try to reform campaign finance. He's going to try to get soft money, that is, contributions made directly to the parties, out of politics. He is going to expand programs for veterans. He is going to attempt to increase the military budget because he feels the military has been hollowed out during the Clinton administration. He is going to introduce a tax cut plan. He is going to introduce a way to save Social Security, perhaps a bill that would allow people to invest some of their Social Security money in secure investments like mutual funds. He has a health care plan, and if you go on his website, which is McCain2000.com, you can see his plan. He has policy statements for all of those areas. But
Bill Mullen, let me just ask. The New York Times says this morning that he's thin. He remains thin on domestic policy. He has trouble remembering which is Medicare and which is Medicaid. He naturally moves more to literature, fiction, history, and foreign affairs than to the way the government works for, you know, the average American.
Well, see, I just don't buy the fact that the president needs to be this, like, master administrator who knows every detail, like a Jimmy Carter.
Well, I agree with you. We're not electing a manager.
Yeah, we're electing a leader. And, I mean, I think McCain has been in the Senate in Congress for 18 years, and he is very familiar with most issues, and I mean, he talks about foreign affairs more because that's his audience and that's his background. But I have been at a lot of press conferences, John McCain. I was on the Straight Talk Express that everybody talks about when it was like me and three other guys on the Straight Talk Express. Nobody was fighting over seats back then. In fact, I was in New Hampshire with McCain when myself and my photographer were his entire press entourage. And I've seen him in these town hall meetings, and I have yet to see the man be stumped by any question on any issue. And there are people that pop up and ask him like stuff that I would like totally, like, I have no idea what this man is talking about, and McCain will have the context and know. This idea that he's, you know, and then who's the other guy in the race that, like, Bush doesn't even know where foreign countries are. So, I mean, he's going to, you know, he's the great domestic policy guy. I mean, unless it has to do with, Texas and College Station or something, I don't know that he's really any more an expert on anything than McCain.
Bill Mullen, you know the story as well as anybody I know. Is it basically in conformity with the romance that the American people seem to have fallen in with?
What's that?
Well, I mean, is the love affair with the John McCain story based on reality as you understand it?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, he's somebody that has a background, and I think people are searching for someone that they can get behind, someone who can be a leader. You know, I think McCain brings a lot of those qualities.
Is he going to beat Bush in the Arizona primary?
Yes. He'll. I mean, he's going to do very well in South Carolina, and, you know, he's a local guy here. I don't see any way he could lose this primary to Bush at this point. He is surging, and, you know, your local guy, the only way he could have lost it if he was not viable when they got here. If he was just at 5% or something nationally, people may have...
Bill Mueller,
forget it.
I got to say thank you and hope
okay.
we can do it again. Bill Mueller
right.
of the Arizona Republic, thanks to Camille Padilla. Thanks also to Ed Walsh of the Washington Post who joined us at the top of the hour. And thanks to all the callers and the listeners. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
Are available for $15, including shipping and handling. To order, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Connected Corporation of Natick, a pre-IPO company using the Internet to protect and recover a PC's data. Career opportunities at www.connected.com.